Hello, and welcome to another installment of Exiting the Cave Short Reads. We're working on The Consolation of Philosophy by Boethius, and this week is Chapter 5. In this chapter, Boethius finally reaches the climax of his woe with a poetic lamentation and an accusation to God, evoking not just the wrath of Job, but a pantheon of Greek mythology to describe and illustrate the orderly heavens created by God, and begging to know why human affairs lack that same orderly beauty. Let's listen in and see what Lady Philosophy has to say about it. I'll see you on the other side. Builder of yon starry dome, thou that whirlest throned eternal heaven-swift globe, and, as they roam, guidest the stars by laws supernal, so in full-sphered splendor dight Cynthia dims the lights of night, but unto the orb fraternal closer drawn doth lose her light. Who at fall of eventide Hesper his cold radiance showeth, Lucifer his beams doth hide, paling as the sun's light groweth brief, while winter's frost holds sway by thy will the space of day. Swift when summer's fervor gloweth, speed the hours of night away. Thou dost rule the changing year. When rude Boreas oppresses, fall the leaves. They reappear, wooed by Zephyr's soft caresses. Fields that Sirius burns deep-grown by Arcturus's watch were sown. Each the reign of law confesses keeps the place that is his own. Sovereign ruler, lord of all, can it be that thou disdainest only men? Gainst him, poor thrall, wanton fortune plays her vainest. Guilt's deserved punishment falleth on the innocent. High uplifted the profanest, on the just their malice vent. Virtue cowers in dark retreats, crime's foul stain the righteous beareth, perjury and false deceits hurt not him the wrong who dareth. But whene'er the wicked trust in ill strength to work their lust, kings whom nations awe declareth mighty grovel in the dust. Look, oh, look upon this earth, thou who on law's sure foundation framest all. Have we no worth, we poor men of all creation? Sore we toss on fortune's tide. Master, bid the waves subside, and earth's ways with consummation of thy heaven's order guide. When I had poured out my griefs in this long and unbroken strain of lamentation, she, with calm countenance, and in no wise disturbed at my complainings, thus spake. When I saw thee sorrowful in tears, I straightway knew thee wretched and an exile. But how far distant that exile I should not know, had not thine own speech revealed it. Yet how far indeed from thy country hast thou not been banished, but rather hast strayed? Or, if thou wilt have it banishment, hast banished thyself. For no one else could ever lawfully have had this power over thee. Now, if thou wilt call to mind from what country thou art sprung, it is not ruled, as once was the Athenian polity, by the sovereignty of the multitude, but one is its ruler, one is its king, who takes delight in the number of his citizens, not in their banishment. To submit to whose governance and to obey whose ordinances is perfect freedom. Art thou ignorant of that most ancient law of this thy country, whereby it is decreed that no one whatsoever who hath chosen to fix there his dwelling may be sent into exile? For truly there is no fear that one who is encompassed by its ramparts and defenses should deserve to be exiled. But he who has ceased to wish to dwell therein, he likewise ceases to deserve to do so. And so it is not so much the aspect of this place which moves me, as thy aspect. Not so much the library walls set off with glass and ivory which I miss, as the chamber of thy mind, wherein I once placed not books, but that which gives books their value, the doctrines which my books contain. Now what thou hast said of thy services to the commonweal is true, only too little compared with the greatness of thy deservings. The things laid to thy charge whereof thou hast spoken, whether such as redound to thy credit or mere false accusations, are publicly known. As for the crimes and deceits of the informers, thou hast rightly deemed it fitting to pass them over lightly, because the popular voice hath better and more fully pronounced upon them. Thou hast bitterly complained of the injustice of the Senate. Thou hast grieved over my calumniation, and likewise hast lamented the damage to my good name. Finally, thine indignation blazed forth against fortune. Thou hast complained of the unfairness with which thy merits have been recompensed. Last of all, thy frantic muse framed a prayer that the peace which reigns in heaven might rule earth also. But since a throng of tumultuous passions hath assailed thy soul, since thou art distraught with anger, pain, and grief, strong remedies are not proper for thee in this thy present mood. And so for a time I will use milder methods. That the tumors which have grown hard through the influx of disturbing passion may be softened by gentle treatment till they can bear the force of sharper remedies. Welcome back. So I hope you enjoyed that. Chapter 5 is the last passage of Introductory Lamentation we'll hear from Boethius. From here forward, the book will begin to appear much more like a Socratic dialogue. Often Boethius will seem vaguely familiar, like Glaucon from the Republic, for example. To be sure, Socrates. You're quite right, Socrates. Yes, Socrates. And so forth. But Boethius' engagement with Lady Philosophy is a bit more confrontational than that, as you'll see when we progress. Before we move on to the philosophical debate, however, I just want to cover a few of the remaining mythopoetic references from this particular poem. The starry dome mentioned in the poem is, of course, the firmament, and this is a direct callback to Genesis, of course, at the point which God divides the waters of the deep. The reference to Genesis should signal both the starting point of the dialogue and the dialogue's telos, which is that Lady Philosophy is to act as Boethius' guide back to his own happiness. The rest of the poem is a pantheon of Greek gods. Cynthia is a pseudonym for Selene, the Greek personification of the moon, sometimes also an epithet for Artemis, goddess of wilderness and the moon. Hesper is an abbreviation of Hesperus, of course, the Greek personification of the evening star. She is actually the sister of Phosphorus, whom Boethius has chosen in this poem to call by his other name, Lucifer, i.e. the morning star. And Zephyrus is the personification of the west wind and the bringer of spring. He's also considered a competitor to Apollo, which is interesting because Apollo is associated with the moon. And as we saw earlier, Apollo features in implication in some of the earlier chapters. So as for the more serious philosophical points made in this chapter, there are basically two that I want to cover. One is theological in nature, and the other is quasi-metaphysical. The first is the phrase, one is its king, one is its ruler, in the prose passage. This, it seems to me, is clearly a reference to the Neoplatonic view of God's kingdom as the ultimate unity. Note how philosophy tells Boethius, also, that exile and banishment are willful self-impositions. This is actually a commonly held Catholic understanding of what hell is today. This will come up again in later chapters, but here the point is that philosophy is claiming to be Boethius' guide back to that ultimate union. My second point is going to start with a quote from Immanuel Kant. Two things awe me most, the starry sky above me and the moral law within me. The reason this seems important to me is because it evokes the very problem with which Boethius is confronting us in this passage. The physical universe is a natural harmony of laws and orderly behaviors, as far as Boethius can see, and yet the affairs of mankind are anything but orderly, and as witnessed by his own fate, often utterly unjust. What are we to make of this apparent discord? How can we justify it in the face of a belief in an all-knowing, all-loving God? This will become a central theme in the coming books, and we'll deal with it more thoroughly there when it comes up. I just want to point it out here to make you aware of what's coming. And finally, I wanted to note a point of influence that Boethius has had. Many authors, long after Boethius was gone, were reading Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, one of the most notable being Shakespeare. I'm going to finish this episode with Shakespeare's Sonnet 29, which, as you'll hear, evokes the same themes Boethius has been addressing in these first five books, and offers a foreshadowing of Boethius's own redemption. When, in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I, all alone, beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy, contented least. Yet in these thoughts myself almost despising, haply I think on thee, and then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising, from sullen earth sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings, that then I scorn to change my state with kings.